just goes romance instead. All right, I have a robot report. This is good.
You have what?
A robot report.
A robot report.
Some of you, if you listen to the show regularly, then you probably remember that some time ago, perhaps a month or two ago, we gave away as a prize. We were having a jingle contest to write a jingle for my new anti-mosquito campaign, Flick Don't Squash, because I discovered it was better to flick mosquitoes than squash them, because if you squash them, toxic things from inside the mosquito go inside you and kill you. So we were trying to get people to flick mosquitoes away instead of squashing them, and our jingle winner won this robot that we had here. It was an actual robot that walked and talked and hurled its own feces. And, so we gave that woman that robot. She lived in East Haddam, remember?
Yeah.
And we never heard from her again, which leads me to believe that the robot killed her.
I think you're right.
We're sorry.
You should check with police in that area.
You know, at the time, that was the most disgusting robot I ever heard of. But this is an actual news report. According to, I don't know what this is. Oh, this is the Friesian Press, Agence, whatever it's called. You know what I'm talking about, AFP. A British-built robot generates its own power by gobbling flies. They're trying to develop a robot that's what they call release and forget, which would be robots that you could just release into, say, a toxic site or something like that, dangerous, inhospitable areas, like here, like at the off-world colony.
Yeah, sounds like the perfect setup for me.
Military, security, industrial sites. Trump is building these kinds of robots down the street. And you just turn them loose somewhere where, you know, it's toxic, and then you don't have to recharge them. You want a robot that ultimately will run on itself, will generate its own power, right?
Mm-hmm.
You follow me so far?
So this thing eats flies?
Okay, yeah. Here's what it does.
How much energy can you get from a fly?
First of all, you have to load the robot with human sewage. This is actually true. You load it up, they have 8 microbial fuel cells loaded with human sewage. And the bacteria in the sewage eat the soft tissue of the flies. The flies get lured in. And of course, the flies like the sewage. They smell the sewage, they go right for it. So they go in there. This is the most disgusting robot ever. I'm not making this thing up.
Of course not.
The whole idea is that they go in there, the bacteria eat the soft tissue of the flies. That releases enzymes that break down in the hardened shell made from a sugary substance called chitin, which comprises the insect's hard exterior, their exoskeleton.
Uh-huh.
The sugar molecules released from the degraded chitin, are then absorbed and used as energy by the bacteria, which in so doing release electrons that are harnessed to generate current. The British Weekly New Scientist reports in next Saturday's issue about this whole thing. So the point behind this experiment, as I say, is to create release and forget roving droids that would form bands and go wilding and rape and pillage. Well, maybe not. The robot is called EcoBot 2, as though it's ecological to have a robot loaded with human sewage going around eating flies and using them to generate energy.
I think it's a wonderful idea.
By the way, I have to credit the Houston Chronicle's blog, Nemo, hosted by Kerry O'Connor, for this, or I just help it pay. But anyway, that's where I found out about it. Very energy. Actually, these robots can travel around for 5 whole days on just 8 flies. If they get the really big flies, they're like, you know,
right,
the big fat flies.
Yeah.
They have one in each fuel cell. That's enough to power the robot for 5 days.
Uh-huh. So does the robot come with like a EPA rating? Like you get with a car, you know, your car,
oh, yeah,
you expect 21 miles per the gallon,
right,
that kind of thing.
Well, I just told you, it's like,
well, yeah, but I mean,
5 days.
Would it be broken down into like big flies,
Titan,
and mosquitoes, then maybe some black flies?
Somebody call in and say it was called Titan, C-H-I-T-N, it's called Titan, I'm sorry,
okay.
I didn't know how it was pronounced.
You can't know everything.
In Florida, they're working on a robot, a train-like device called Choo Choo that uses microbial fuel cells for its power.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know whether it uses poop or not.
What do? They fill it up and it screws up elections?
Well, in Choo Choo's case, the bacteria feed on sugar cubes. It sounds like this is not so smelly. But right now, unfortunately, the poop-fueled robot, they haven't really worked out the whole thing where the flies just go in by themselves, so they have to hand feed the dead blue bottle work. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is to make the droid predatory so that the sewage would draw the flies in.
It's a disgusting future that we have to look forward to. I always thought the future was going to be kind of clean and shiny and stuff like that. I didn't realize we're going to be robots lurching around reeking of poop and eating flies. Well, film strips are not, in fact, experimental films, but they are the formation, they are part of the sort of formative elements of our cognition. If we are men and women of a certain age, as Bruce and I are, we grew up during the golden age of classroom film strips. And, in fact, that's why we're so able to relate to Change Your Underwear Twice a Week by Danny Gregory, a book about the golden age of classroom film strips. And Danny Gregory joins us now. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, good. We enjoy your book very much, although it's sort of, it's Proustian, you know, it kind of triggers all kinds of weird flashbacks as we watch these things. Maybe we could begin, there might be some actual young people out there who don't even know what a film strip is. I'll let you explain it.
Sure. Well, a film strip is basically a strip of celluloid, like any kind of 35-millimeter film would be, kind of like a slide film, basically, and it usually would come coiled up in a little plastic canister. You take it out, feed it into a very simple kind of projector, and project it onto the wall, and you turn a knob, and you go from frame to frame, and each frame would have a photograph or an illustration or puppets or cartoons, and usually there would be a line of type at the bottom that would kind of tell you what the story was about. Then later on, records and then cassettes provided the story, the narrative, and often you'd hear a beep that would tell you on the track of the tape that it was time to turn to the next frame.
And in general, I mean, these film strips, they performed all kinds of purposes, but you could probably break them down into a few different categories. For example, product manufacturers, or like the bakery industry, would put out a film strip about bread, you know, where bread comes from and stuff like that, right? And then there would be sort of hygiene things, you know, and
they would be well-veiled if they came from a corporation. They would usually be masquerading as some kind of information. So, for instance, if the bakers put it together, they would make it seem like it was just sort of an innocent story about bread, but there would be a bit of a corporate agenda underneath the surface. But they also fell into categories like health and hygiene, you know, how to eat properly, how to stand up straight, you know, not to put pencils up your nose, wear a coat in the winter, that kind of thing.
Sunlight is good for you. You should be out in the sun as much as possible, right?
Exactly. And then go home and sleep for 12 hours every night.
and you could also sort of, you can look at these film strips, which I guess were popular from about 1945 to 1975, and you could get a little bit of the psychology of America out of them. Would that be fair to say?
That's what I tried to do in the book, was really to say not only, you know, these things are kind of fun and interesting and nostalgic, but also what was going on at the time? What was the context in which a kid would be living when he or she first saw this film strip? So, you know, for instance, there's a film strip all about machines that make roads, and that film strip came out more or less at the same time that the highway system was being built in America. So what now may seem kind of humdrum, at the time was a pretty exciting change in the country.
In general, I would say one thing, I mean, just even reviewing all the film strips that you have collected in this book, and the book is really a lot of fun to read. I mean, the film strips are kind of amusing in sort of a kitschy way, and then your analysis of them is both interesting and funny. But I would say one of the messages that wasn't ever in any film strip, that you found anyway, was question authority.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, basically the whole idea of the film strips is sort of accept things the way they are, right?
I think that's probably the rule even today, but in schools. But I think, yes, absolutely. It was, you know, try and be a productive member of society, understand what role other people have. You know, there's an entire film strip that's basically about standing in line, how to stand in line to go into the playground, how to stand in line at the water cooler, and so forth. That was, standing in line was probably one of the most important activities of the time.
Yeah. I believe that was called Stay in Line and Keep to the Right. Well, that's what your chapter's called, right? The title actually does come from a 1946 film strip, right? Which is about you and your clothes.
Exactly. What to wear at certain times of the year. Take off your shoes when they get wet. Don't go tobogganing in a sundress. That kind of thing.
And I mean, another message that seems to come out of a lot of these film strips is
rather than sort of the idea that we ought to be careful stewards of the earth, there's more sort of the idea that the earth is there to be exploited by us.
Absolutely. It's a cornucopia that's put there for our benefit, and to, you know, there's a whole lot we can get out of the earth if we just kind of put our minds to it.
So you should be really allowed to use as much electricity as you want and extract anything from the ground that you can find.
Absolutely. Those were miracles.
Yeah. And do we also see, I mean, I think of the 1950s, at least before the last 4 years, I thought of the 1950s as a terribly paranoid time in American life. I guess you get some of that in the film strip, right?
I think so. I mean, I think there's a sense that people in other countries are, you know, on one level, yeah, they're just like us, but really they're different, they're primitive, they're kind of weird, and we need to constantly be reminded, of course, that a lot of them were our enemies. So when Germans and Japanese are depicted, we're reminded of what they did in the past.
Does anything currently exist that takes the place of film strips? I mean, I guess you could sort of say all of mass culture, but is there anything in particular that, I mean, the film strip technology seems incredibly outmoded and antiquated.
Well, you know, there are different ways of looking at it. On one level, PowerPoint is a replacement for it. Film strips had a big role in corporations for training people, so PowerPoint obviously has replaced that, and also in the classroom. I think, you know, the web is certainly a source for information, but I think the whole focus of teaching has changed a lot, and I think the idea of everybody sitting in rows in the dark watching a projector and that being a regular part of the educational process has kind of gone away.
The other thing that you notice is that information these days is this very sort of cluttered, multitasking kind of formula, that information is thrown at you in these kind of writhing gobs of multiple meaning and stuff, whereas film strips are a much slower, more orderly, bite-sized universe of information.
Absolutely. It's simple. It is efficient. It's clear. It's single-minded. There's a definite lesson to be gained from each individual film strip.
Yeah.
And you can, you can sit down and read this book from cover to cover and have basically a pretty solid fourth-grade education.
Which I missed the first time around, so it's a very valuable book on that score, too. Danny Gregory, thanks very much for being with us once again. The book's called Change Your Underwear Twice a Week, Lessons from the Golden Age of Classroom Film Strips. Great book.
Thanks a lot.
Great, bye-bye. But anyway, today there were two other guys in the class, and one of them came up to me afterwards and began talking to me, which, of course, as you know, I don't like.
I was going to say, well, Bobby Sherwood wasn't there, so who else could it have been?
He began talking to me, and it was one of those things where, as you know, I also had a tremendous amount of trouble recognizing people by their faces.
Right.
So I was looking at him thinking...
Even if they're wearing a name tag.
Yeah. No, if they're wearing a name tag, I'm fine, because I can remember names really well. You know, as a matter of fact, if you took somebody that I hadn't seen in years, and somebody who'd grown a long beard and it had like an extra eye grafted onto his forehead and had had some other surgical work done and stuff like that, and then put a name tag on him and had him walk in here, I'd know exactly, based on the name, who this person was, even if he didn't look like the way he'd looked years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody could look pretty much the way they looked the last time I saw them, and if I don't know what their name is, then I don't know who they are. So anyway, this guy was talking to me, and I'm kind of thinking... Maybe I know him, maybe I don't. Because one of the things that I've tried to do as part of becoming a nicer person, full of more bonhomie.
When did that start?
Well, I mean, it's evolution going on over the course of some time here. One thing I do is I try to ask people what their name is. If they're talking to me and they say, hi, I like the show, but today, you know, you're great, all this kind of stuff. I always say, oh, good, and what's your name? And they say, I'm your uncle. You know, it's that kind of thing. So I was in one of those moments where I thought, oh, and who might you be, or what's your name, or something like that.
Well, you don't want to embarrass it. You don't want to make them feel like you've forgotten them.
And then it turns out I know them pretty well, or something like that. That's going to be really bad. On the other hand, I don't want to seem I don't care who they are.
Right. In this case, it was Bill Curry, so there was a problem.
Yeah, it was. It's almost not that. But anyway, I was trying to think... What could I say? Because I was on the bubble here about whether I knew this guy or not. So I said, have you been coming to yoga? Have you come to other classes? And he said, yes. And he said, I'm Mike Harder. So Mike Harder is like this hockey, he's the only hockey player, the only Wolfpack hockey player that I think we've ever had on the show, and certainly the only Wolfpack hockey player that we would ever have on the show ever again.
Well, Ken Jordander's pretty good.
Is he good?
Yeah.
Good in what sense?
Well, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not like an alcoholic with no teeth.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well,
he never actually exploded any further than just.
But Mike Hart is really funny. We used to have him on the show. He's really funny. He's a very creative, interesting guy. And but I didn't. I mean, even so, I wouldn't expect to find a pro hockey player doing yoga.
Why not?
I don't know. It just doesn't seem like.
Wouldn't that be good for them?
Oh, it would be good for them. There's lots of things that would be good for them that they probably don't do, though. But I suppose if any pro hockey player was going to be doing hot room yoga, it would be Mike Harder.
Yeah.
So it was just very exciting to see.
One thing you should, and I'm sure you do understand this about pro hockey players, is many of them are rather rough and tough.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And if one were to run one's mouth about them, it could be bad.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons that I was surprised, because ordinarily there's no fighting in yoga. Like, you know, it's rare that
a fight broke out today?
No, but I just assume hockey players, you know, they like some place where you can take a swing at
somebody. So there's a good chance that they want to be in a place where there's a chance something might break out.
Yeah, exactly. It just didn't seem like the kind of thing, you know.
Cross-checking at yoga.
Right. It's very rare that somebody, you know, people just throw down their yoga blocks, you know, and just go at it and start wailing at each other. It happens once in a while.
So when we last talked to Mike Carter, he had been traded to somebody, hadn't he?
Yeah, traded to some crap team somewhere.
Yeah.
And not only that, but that had caused the Wolfpack to have a curse placed on him, like the curse of the Bambino, where, in my opinion, Wolfpack will never win again.
They'll
never win the Calder Cup again, anyway.
Recall this curse.
Yeah, there's a curse.
Oh, there is?
Yeah, because they traded Mike Carter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What would that curse be called?
Curse of the
Hartino?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Thanks.
And they'll never,
notice,
as a result of that, they'll never win the
Calder Cup ever again.
Right. And many of them will be unable to reproduce.
Well.
And all the little children who love the Wolfpack so much will go to bed in tears every night. Because
I was wasting my time then being there last year with those Wilkes-Barre people.
Getting in fights with thugs.
Listening to a bunch of mouthy people.
No account steel towns? Yeah, I would say, yeah, you were wasting your time.
So I was wasting my time. Had I known that, I didn't know about this curse then, I wouldn't have bothered to go.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying they won't have winning seasons, but they'll never win the Calder Cup again.
Okay.
Until.
This was the playoffs.
Yeah.
So.
Until. Something has to be done to make the curse be lifted.
I'm not even going to.
Well, I don't even know what it is.
Bring back Mike Harder? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. No,
is he still playing?
Yes, he would be. Yes, he. Well, if anybody's playing. I guess there's some question as to whether people will play hockey.
Yes.
Yeah. Does maybe the UN sort of maybe suggested maybe
work
would be better off if people didn't play hockey?
Well, the Canada won the World Cup, and they said that might be it for a long time, for even years before we see hockey again.
And why is that?
Because of the work stoppage.
Yeah.
Because the owners don't want to pay the high salaries anymore, and the players are used to getting the high salaries, and you know, the economic realities, as they say, are slapping everybody.
Some were paid in Labatt or something. They up 6 or 7 cases.
Well, whatever happened to the love of the game?
Yeah,
yeah.
So anyway, I think he is still playing hockey.
Well, good. I always thought he was a pretty good hockey player.
He's a good hockey player. When he was playing hockey, I actually went to the Wolfpack games. Can you imagine?
No.
No, but I did. I went and saw at least one and maybe more than one Wolfpack game. But
because of Mike Harder?
Yes, because I wanted to go cheer for Mike Harder.
Yeah.
But I don't go anymore, and I never will.
Well, it's because
the curse is lifted. Yeah. We should figure out some way for the curse to be lifted.
The Hartino.
Yeah. We should figure out. It must involve, like... Well,
it's going to involve something bad, I can tell.
Yeah, like blood has to be taken from the heart of, you know, Kevin Nathan or something.
Well, I don't think that seems a little extreme.
Squirted on the ice by the Zamboni or something. It'll be something pretty significant.
Why Kevin Nathan?
I don't know. I'm just picking some random sports guy. He's a sports guy, isn't he?
Yes.
All right. There you go. That's why.
He's on this station, you know.
Yeah, I know he is.
Okay.
You
did realize that.
Yeah. Or you know what it is? The curse can be lifted when only if Donnie Marshall's head can be rubbed on the ice, the center ice.
No.
But there's something, you know, it has to be more complicated than that. He has to not want it to happen, though. So people have to take Donnie Marshall and turn him upside down and rub his head on the...
dangle him from the back of a speeding Zamboni.
Right. Something like that. On the ice. But on the center ice.
At ice level.
At the center ice.
At center ice.
It's a little circle where they face off.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what has to happen.
Hi, this is Ray Dunaway.
I'm Diane Smith.
All right, coming up on Thursday morning. Wow, the weekend is almost here. So is the UConn game against BC.
And so we're going to talk to Randy Edsall about that, UConn's football coach, naturally. Also, what is with all these hurricanes? They just don't want to stop. We'll get an in-depth look at that. Plus, the governor, she's had an extremely busy week. She's going to check in with us, and we'll talk about some of the hot topics on the local spectrum. So that's what's coming up.
And what kind of weekend are we looking at? Well, the five-day forecast of 25 past right here on WTIC. News Talk 1080.
True or false? Home ownership, regardless of income, can predict success for children. Hello, I'm George Baumlin, the president of United Way, the capital area. If you said...
So they had the NHL lockout? Probably bad news for dentists as well. But the new hockey teams are laying off some of their other personnel, so it's your chance to hire a Zamboni guy to do your driveway. It's time for Sports à Trois, the very French sports discussion segment with Monsieur Ambrosio,
oui.
Monsieur Bruce Stevens, and myself, Louis Gascon de la Mer.
Maybe all the Zamboni drivers can go down to the places where the hurricanes have hit and help out down there.
Yeah.
Let's do the question.
Now, we may have dealt with this particular subject in the past. I'm not sure. I can't remember, but it's always worth revisiting. Anyway,
sure.
Question came in. Dear Mr. Ambrosio, what is quicksand? How is it formed?
We have dealt with it.
And how do you get out of it?
You get out of it by keeping completely still and not thrashing around like an animal. And quicksand is basically a combination of about 17 different agents, and the biggest agent in it is the water. A lot of people think it's the sand or the goop or the muck, but that's not the case. It's the water that causes people the most problems. And people, you know, in the movies and on action TV shows, they always show people dying from quicksand.
Yeah.
But there's been very few deaths caused by quicksand. The biggest problem is that the stuff gets in your clothes and you can never get it out.
Yeah, it probably gets in parts of you that you can never get out of, too.
Exactly. Well, there have been that. We could talk about that if we do a show, say, from midnight to 6 on the FM.
If you don't move in the quicksand, how do you get out?
Help.
About the fact that he'd been reading about the fact that, you know, Bush mangles the language and he says strange things like, I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family, or families is where our nation finds hopes, where wings take dream.
If only the man had gotten an education, you know.
And you know, the other thing about gynecologists practicing their love and stuff like that. Well, anyway, this doctor in The Atlantic is positing the possibility anyway. He discovered that during the debates with Ann Richards, when he was running for governor, which was very effective and articulate, and he really wasn't regarded as somebody who didn't know how to speak English. And he's wondering, through his 40s, Bush appeared to be perfectly articulate, whether in fact he may have a presenile dementia. A fairly typical Alzheimer's situation that develops significantly earlier in life. And he says President Bush's mangled words are a demonstration of what physicians call confabulation and are almost specific to the diagnosis of a true dementia. And he says, based on that, he writes that Bush should be started on drugs that offer the possibility of retarding the slow but inexorable course of the disease. Now, that's just sort of one opinion. And Alex actually went out and got other opinions from other neurologists who said basically that it's just irresponsible to speculate about somebody's condition based on just observation of them and checking the record for how they used to talk and stuff like that. But just to give you one more thing to worry about. Maybe it's not just this little cute thing where he, you know, inverts language and stuff like that. Maybe we have another case of a president with presenile dementia. Just another thing to worry about. Oh, and then back to Martha Stewart for a second. This is a very, very good AP story. Clears up some of the things you might be wondering about. First of all, at Danbury, you can't decorate the walls of your... You just have the sort of concrete or cinder block walls of the room. You're not allowed to decorate them. You can't put up blocked wallpaper or anything like that. You can put as many as 4 photographs in your locker, but that's about it. Also, she's 62 years old, and she would probably get the bottom bunk if she has one of those roommate situations, because the Danbury policy does not put women over 50 in the top bunk.
Okay.
Wondering, you know, whether she'd be climbing up there.
Yeah, I was quite concerned about that.
There was one other important thing there. Well, first of all, in some parts of the prison, those with the cleanest cells get to eat first. So, you know, the fact that she's a good housekeeper, assuming she really is a good housekeeper. And they are required to work. They can request certain jobs such as plumbing, electrical, or maintenance work. But new arrivals with shortened sentences tend to get kitchen work. Although that sounds good, but it's not. It can require being up at 4 a.m. for the breakfast detail. Somehow, I don't think Martha's going to like that too much.
I wouldn't think so.
So anyway, prison, you know, despite what we sort of conjure up in our heads, prison is never fun. It's never easy. And Martha Stewart is not going to have a happy time there. Anyway, we'd like to thank everybody who helped out with today's show, especially Garrett Condon and our producer, Bobby Sherwood.